The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. We've got an interesting show for you. Unless you've been living under a rock, you will have seen some news about Bitcoin this week. More specifically, about the website known as Silk Road. Now, as the anecdotes go, or as the stories go, Silk Road was a site dedicated to the trade of illicit drugs and other such commodities and items. Basically through the internet. So it was anonymous. The creator of this apparently was able to do this for a number of years. And recently, as of a couple of days ago, the FBI shut down the Silk Road illicit online marketplace. Now, Bitcoin was one of the primary currencies used on the Silk Road platform. And so this has been one of the challenges is whenever you hear about Bitcoin, although Bitcoin has been a tremendous vehicle for cross-border transactions, frictionless cross-border currency, you could say, there's always hanging over the head of Bitcoin has been this Silk Road marketplace. So the real question is, Ross Ulbricht, who allegedly ran this site, his hacker named Dread Pirate Roberts, was this really the Bitcoin economy or a large enough part of the Bitcoin economy that now that Silk Road has gone down, it's going to change the way Bitcoin is perceived or used in the market? That's one of the things we want to start off with today, but then really looking at the road to legitimacy for digital currencies. Of course, Bitcoin is not the first digital currency out there. We have QQ in China that rose to fame in around 2006, 2007. Linden dollars, which were the currency of note for Second Life. So Bitcoin is not the first digital currency to come along. In fact, you could argue that reward points and miles for airline programs are a form of digital currency also. But Bitcoin has sparked the imagination because of its ability to conduct real, legitimate, commodity trades and conduct foreign currency cross-border in a very rapid digital manner. Well, we're going to welcome to the show today one of the key people in the Bitcoin Foundation, John Matonis. John, what is your role with the Bitcoin Foundation? You must have been busy the last few days, but tell us about how you got started with this and what your role is with the Bitcoin Foundation.
Sure, Brett. Thanks for having me on the program. I'm very happy to share that. I've been on the board of directors for the Bitcoin Foundation for 1 year now, and in July I was voted in as the executive director. So the Bitcoin Foundation is only 1 year old right now. Actually, I think it's almost our 1 year anniversary a few days ago. So we've made tremendous progress in that very short time, especially compared to other open source nonprofit type organizations. And principally, the Bitcoin Foundation's mission is to standardize and protect the protocol. So we're concerned with the areas that you mentioned on legitimacy. I want to focus on market-based legitimacy, and in terms that's in terms of standardizing the protocol. In terms of protecting the protocol, We're interested in focusing in areas that that really point out to the public and reaffirm the fact that Bitcoin is a strong protocol for the long term, based on cryptographic primitives that have existed for the last 10 to 15 years. So it's not something that just shot on the scene as some wonder kid.
So, you know, how did you get started in all this? What drove you to be a part of this revolution in the way, a currency works?
Well, for me personally, I mean, I can only speak to me personally. I was involved in digital currency and digital cash in the mid-90s when we had the famous, DigiCash patent and protocol from David Chaum out of the Netherlands. At the time, I was working for Visa International as the foreign exchange dealer in San Francisco. So I was responsible, my team was responsible for about 165 different currency rates that went into the Visa interchange and clearing system. So we had a good view on the world in terms of retail payments and what types of currencies were being used. From there, it made a lot of sense for somebody like Visa to introduce a non-political monetary unit. It's very appealing on many levels to have a non-political monetary unit, and I actually proposed that to Visa. It didn't gain a lot of traction, but then it wasn't until Bitcoin came along in early 2009 that we actually had a functioning non-political digital currency unit. I guess you could say that I've been preparing for this for the last 20 years of my life.
So, in terms of, from your point of view, what is that the real differentiation of Bitcoin as a currency or as a means of exchange? What's the distinct advantage that Bitcoin offers versus something like the US dollar? And why has it captured the imagination of so many people worldwide?
Well, I think that the main difference compared to the U.S. dollar and other national units is that Bitcoin is non-national, non-political in nature. So it's more similar to gold and silver in that regard. The gold bugs, if they would think it through, would be very much on board for something like Bitcoin because it has a fixed supply and it's not linked to any nation's political agenda. So that's the major difference compared to the U.S. dollar and the euro and pound and yen and so forth. In terms of Bitcoin with respect to other digital currencies from the mid-90s, late 90s, the breakthrough in the technology was really focusing on the solving of the double spend problem in a decentralized manner. And prior to Bitcoin, the double spend problem always had to be solved with a centralized issuer, even with DigiCash. Mm-hmm. What that means is that you have to protect against double spending online by going back to the issuing mint, verifying that your coins were not spent, and then reissuing them. The great breakthrough technology that the world has enjoyed with Bitcoin is the decentralized and distributed blockchain, which actually solves the double spend problem without a centralized issuer, and therefore it does not rely on any third-party intermediary to clear and settle trades.
Now, one of the reasons that Bitcoin has this sort of funny classification, the market doesn't quite know how to deal with it. Some have classified it almost as a commodity because of the nature of it. So what your analogy with gold is actually quite interesting. But one of the reasons Bitcoin is so easy to use is if you want to transfer money from person A to person B, it's extremely simple and very frictionless. And we live in a world within the banking space today that you have networks like the SWIFT network and so forth and the Visa and MasterCard networks. But at their core, if you want to send money, if I want to send you money, I have to know quite a bit of information about you before I can do that. I mean, we've had some breakthroughs with PayPal and so forth, but wire transfers and counterparty identification, all of these sorts of things have been, you know, it's got more and more complex, it appears, even though we're getting faster and better electronic systems to send money, you know, across border from person A to person B and have that, you know, currency exchange handled, as well as identify who are the two people and what's the source of those funds and so forth. And Bitcoin really freed up that complexity and has made it very simple for money to be transferred across border. But also there's been concerns about the fact that you could do that with anonymity. So can you explain, for those that aren't familiar with the way you actually would send money through using Bitcoin, could you explain how that happens and how people are identified or in that transaction between two parties trading on Bitcoin?
Well, sure. One of the major uses of Bitcoin is peer-to-peer payments or person-to-person payments, which is very cost-effective to do with Bitcoin and very smooth. I would encourage a lot of people who haven't actually experienced it to see how liberating the process is, because what you get with Bitcoin is what's known as user-defined privacy, which means that rather than having to reveal all of your identity information to open an account, like you would at a traditional bank, the user or the customer is in charge of what they would like to reveal. So think of it as a sliding scale of privacy. You can place yourself at the full disclosure end of the scale, or you could place yourself at the extreme never want to be known or seen end of the scale. Now, the point of that, though, is that where you set yourself on that sliding scale is actually up to the customer and actually up to the user, which is precisely where it should be.
Yes. Rather than having sort of this defined parameter that you've got to live up to in every case. If you don't, then the transfer could fail, or you could have a money laundering issue on your hands and so forth.
Well, exactly, and because there's no third party involved, what you actually end up having is, you know, transactions between two people or a customer and a merchant, where the clearing and settlement window it compresses. And so, for people who are in the payments business and people who are in banking, they'll understand this, because with, you know, credit cards and other types of payments, you have an authorization, you have a clearing, and you have a settlement. So it's basically a three-step process. What Bitcoin does is it compresses all of that into a single moment in time, which is exactly like a physical paper cash transaction. So you have clearing and you have authorization, clearing, and settlement compressed into the same point of time. I think that's very important, because a lot of the credit card systems are built around that premise, where as a merchant, you know, you have to wait 2 days to get your deposits. Bitcoin can really be thought of as a digital version of cash, just like if you were to exchange a 50-pound note to someone, they have it, you no longer have it. Clearing and settlement has happened at the same time, so it's simultaneous.
So, you know, let me ask you about the way the market finds value for Bitcoin. You mentioned before that, like gold, there's a limited supply of Bitcoin. It's very interesting, actually. I was listening to Brian Cox, you know, professor who's on BBC in the UK, and he said that if you take all of the world's supply of gold that exists on the planet, it would fill about 6 Olympic swimming pools, which I thought was an interesting statistic. But how many Bitcoins are out there? You know, what's the potential size of the market? How many are in circulation? What's the value of the Bitcoin economy right now?
Well, actually, for the swimming pool analogy, I heard it was 2 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
But, there you go.
We won't dispute that on the Bitcoin economy. The total market cap, or what you would consider as the money supply, M1 base money supply, is approximately $1.5 billion right now, and that is based on over 11 million bitcoins being mined or issued.
Yep.
Now, that's out of a total maximum of 21 million bitcoins. So the remainder of those Bitcoins will be issued out over, you know, the next 140 years. Actually, 120 years. It'll go to 2140. With
Is that just happen on a regular schedule, or?
Yeah, that's on a published schedule. So the majority of those between now and 2132, but then, you know, the last 108 years is the last 1%. So it's a very asymptotic line. But what I wanted to mention about the value is that because Bitcoin is infinitely subdividable to the right of the decimal point, it currently allows for 8 decimal spaces to the right of the decimal point.
Yeah.
Which could easily be reconfigured to be 12 decimal spaces, 14, 15. You know, that part doesn't matter so much. But we've never had in the history of money something that could be infinitely subdivided and still be usable. Because if you think about gold or silver and subdividing it down to that level, you end up with unusable dust.
Right.
So compare Bitcoin to the currencies of, you know, the Weimar Republic in Germany or Zimbabwe or Yugoslavia or, you know, Brazil when they were inflating. What they do is they move to the left of the decimal point and they add zeros to the left of the decimal point. Right. What Bitcoin does inherent to the protocol is moves to the right of the decimal space and is infinitely subdividable. So it doesn't really matter in the long run that there's 21 million Bitcoin potentially available. That could be that could be 10 million, it could be 5 million, because it's really just an integer at the end of the day. And right. And we
market,
you know,
market sets the value, and then the amount of component or the way that the Bitcoins could be divided sort of depends on how much activity is attributed to Bitcoin, right?
Precisely, precisely. And relating back to your Silk Road description, 26,000 Bitcoin were seized by the feds. Whether they destroy
those. What's going to happen with those Bitcoins?
Well, I believe that they're going to need to be maintained for evidence. I don't think that they can be destroyed unless they're considered contraband. So that means that they'll probably sell them on the market. Which means that I hope that they would use a licensed and regulated exchange like they make the rest of us do.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because the discussion, you know, when this first happened was that, you know, Silk Road was the capture of Silk Road was going to result in the collapse of the Bitcoin economy. But, you know, they're going to have to do something with those Bitcoins. And if they recirculate them, then, you know, presumably unless they, you know, shove them on the market in a glut fashion, that, you know, the market will stabilize again after some time. In fact, it's already starting to, isn't it?
Well, the market has already stabilized after the Silk Road news, so I'm sure that the market could absorb 26,000 Bitcoin, you know, from the FBI. But
so
even if they were to destroy them, it wouldn't matter.
It's 26,000 out of about 11 million in circulation right now, yeah?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, but yeah. Even if they were to destroy them, it wouldn't have a long-term impact on Bitcoin.
So just in about the next 30 seconds or so before we go to break, and we'll come back to this at the in the last segment. But
sure.
You know, where do we go from here? How do we get the legitimacy in terms of the Bitcoin, apart from what's happening right now naturally, which is just more people are using it and it's getting more more well known and more traction?
Well, I'm glad you brought up legitimacy, because what you'll hear from a lot of the the regulators or the regular conventional people in payment systems is that they'll talk about government-based legitimacy or legitimacy based in law. Bitcoin doesn't necessarily require that to be successful or right. functional. What Bitcoin requires is market-based legitimacy, which means that the market is adopting it as a suitable form of payment and money. And to demonstrate that, you can look at how fast and how rapidly we're seeing the applications in the mobile world evolve around Bitcoin, providing definite examples of market-based legitimacy. But even more importantly is the three-digit code that banks and other institutions rely on for currencies. And this is from a non-political standards-based organization at the ISO. It's the ISO 4217 standard for the three-letter currency codes, which gives us the, you know, GBP, EUR, USD. They are currently proposed and under consideration is XBT for Bitcoin, which would mean that Bitcoin is entering the foreign exchange world, the SWIFT world, in terms of a three-digit currency code, which would lend it incredible market-based legitimacy for moving forward.
It's traded on Reuters and all those sorts of things.
Well, and about three or four of the leading retail exchanges are already quoting it as XBT.
Well, fantastic, fantastic. Well, John, can you stick around and join us again on the last segment so we can talk a bit further about this with Mark Brule as well?
Sure, happy to.
Great. So we're just going to head to a break right now. We'll be back talking about the mint chip, the digital currency from the Royal Canadian Mint.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King of Breaking Banks, and this week we're talking digital currencies. We were just speaking to John Matonis, who's with the Bitcoin Foundation, talking about Bitcoin's rise to fame in recent times. But right now what we'd like to do is invite Mark Brule. Mark is the CFO of the Royal Canadian Mint. And at the Royal Canadian Mint, they've been working on their own form of digital currency, is it the code name mint chip, or is that the public name you give to it, Mark?
Well, that's currently how we're branding it, Brett. Yeah.
Right. So tell us about how you guys came to the decision that, you know, a real mint decided that, well, we've got to get in the business of minting digital currency or creating a digital version of the Canadian dollar.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you, Brett, for having me part of your program. And yes, it's my pleasure to tell you a bit about the journey that the Royal Canadian Mint has taken with MintChip. And quite frankly, we see it as a natural evolution, really, of the mint to move from physical coins to a digital cash-like product. The Royal Canadian Mint, for example, has been entrusted for over 100 years with the Canadian coin currency. The notes themselves are the purview of the Bank of Canada. But, we have a trusted brand and we're known for our security around our coinage. And as we look at trade and commerce today and how things are changing, the mint through their R&D program, decided we should look into the electronic payments world, see what was out there, see what are the needs of the marketplace, and what might be something that today's marketplace needs and deserves to have. And through that, we've developed this, what we think is a digital cash-like product called Mintchip.
How long have you guys been working on Mintchip then?
Well, it's interesting. Annually, right, we get together with our board of directors, the senior management, and we have a strategic retreat. And about 4 years ago, during that strategic retreat, we decided that even though we've been watching the evolution of, we'll call it electronic payments, we decided to spend a little bit more time and invest some money in looking at, as I said, what was out in the market, what was needed. So it's around 3 to 4 years that we've been working on this project.
And, you know, where are you currently at in terms of, you know, I know when we met last time you talked about the fact that you are using them internally at the Royal Canadian Mint gift shop and so forth, but how far are we away from, you know, a regular consumer being able to buy mint chip currency?
Well, you know, some of the journey that we've been on, just to backtrack a little bit, about a year ago, we had developed the product and the prototype. We thought we had a very secure product. We thought we had some excellent value propositions to both consumers and merchants. And what we decided back a year ago was to run a software developer challenge. And we put out the challenge to software developers by providing them software developer kits, provided them cloud accounts, and provided them an ecosystem in which they could bet the technology and create an apps that would use our Mintchip app in very innovative ways in trade and commerce.
Right, and, so you had your hackathon for that, right?
I guess that's what you could call it, but we looked at it as a challenge to the software developers, and we ended up prizing winners in the fall of 2012.
And so today, how many people participated in that?
Well, we had a limit of 500 kits that we had put together, and we had assigned all of those within 72 hours. So
Wow. Very, very,
and it went across North America. And we had large and small developers alike, and so it was very successful. We ended up with 57 developed applications for Mintchip being used in transit, peer to peer, and B2C. In fact, there was one that which was prized for charitable donations, and the application took for every payment in Mintchip, you could assign 1 or 2 cents of your payment to a particular charity.
What do you think, you know, how do you see in 10 or 15 years' time when a digital currency like Mintchip is presumably quite common, you know, how do you see people using this? Does it become a replacement for the Canadian dollar? Is it used for specific types of transactions? Is it used specifically in the digital sphere? You know, what's the use case that differentiates this from a run-of-the-mill hard currency?
Well, in one aspect, you know, it's hard to predict what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years. The smartphone has been a game changer of late. But in terms of, you know, some of the attributes I think a digital cash product has is over hard currency is it crosses all channels. So as an example, Mintchip, you can use it at the bricks and mortar environment. You can use it online, and it has a very strong value prop for person-to-person or peer-to-peer type payments, which, you know, you can't push coin or bills or notes down the internet pipe.
Right.
And I think, you know, cash and other electronics, so it's a matter of providing a choice to the consumer that they don't have today for particularly low-value transactions.
So this is what we would typically call sort of micropayments and things like that.
Yes, micro and even nano. You know, with today's payment products online, as an example, if you get under $2 for someone to try to market some digital content, the cost of merchants accepting payments with current products today makes that kind of product almost cost prohibitive. But if you could get the cost of accepting payments down to within pennies, all of a sudden I think you can ignite new online content markets that aren't there today.
Right. So a good example of that would be, you know, there's the app stores that we have today. There's about $26 billion in revenue is generated through app stores through mobile devices, specifically mobile transactions on mobile devices. And 17% of those transactions are in-app purchases, so buying features for games, things like that. These are typically things that are around sort of the 99-cent mark. And processing these payments across the Visa and MasterCard rails, for example, or a bank-to-bank network is quite expensive for, you know, the banks involved, for the customer and everything. So a digital currency could work very well in that space, you're saying?
Absolutely. And I think another market we look to is media content. And, you know, you think about the digital native, so the 18 to 35-year-olds, they're not into the subscription model. You know, Netflix is an example of that. So if you think about media, you think about news articles, rather than trying to market your news media through a subscription model of X amount of dollars a month, why not be able to purchase that medium, buy the article and sell it, you know, for pennies or for a dime?
Now, you know, in terms of the value of the mint chip currency, one of the interesting things here that you guys have made a strategic decision on is that, unlike Bitcoin, where the price of that is set very much by the market, mint chip is in a way the price is set by the market, but it is tied to the Canadian dollar, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In the ecosystem that we envision, there would be an equivalent amount. I'll use the Canadian market, for example, but it doesn't need to be the Canadian market. It could be another country's market, or perhaps could be a global payment type product, but it would be backed by a hard currency, I would call it, of some sort, that people who wished to cash in their particular mint chip, if that's what it's called in those days, would know that it is being backed by whether it's a Canadian dollar currency, or it could be a basket of goods if it was a global type currency.
So if someone buys a mint chip currency, what you're saying is there actually is a physical, you know, Canadian dollar, a loonie or something, sitting somewhere to cater for that mint chip?
In a Canadian market, that's what we envision, yes.
So as mint chip gets more successful and more ubiquitous and more people use it, would that then lead to less physical currency in circulation?
I think there's a natural movement even today to less physical currency being used in the marketplace today. And I think it's the digital market really where you can't use physical market, that there are market opportunities for merchants and therefore for payment products.
And what about the identity issue? You know, so one of the big things we've seen with the discussion around Bitcoin, and particularly the Silk Road news we heard about recently, was that, and one of the big pressures that's come to bear on Bitcoin is, even though it's been in a very, very efficient, in a free market sense, and been able to grow very quickly, and as John pointed out, this is, you know, $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin value floating around in the market. You know, that's been done without a traditional central bank behind it, and the holding of those bitcoins has been done, you know, by non-traditional approaches from an exchange perspective. So you haven't got people in historically coming in through a traditional regulated process to buy that currency, Bitcoin, and identify themselves. And from a money laundering perspective, this is what it appears at least the regulators in the United States have picked up on, is that without identifying the counterparties who are trading that currency, then whether to, you know, you can't know as a central bank or as a regulator in that market, you can't know how much of that trade an individual is conducting cross-border and whether or not they're using those funds for appropriate purposes. So where does identity come into Mintchip as a digital currency in terms of counterparties involved in transactions?
Well, we like to akin it very much to the way cash is today, in that we call it privacy respected. The example, one of the best analogies we can make is you will go to perhaps in a cloud type environment where your accounts, your Mintchip accounts are held by, we call them a broker in the cloud. You'll need to identify yourself to that broker in order to load your Mintchip account either through your own personal bank account, or maybe you might want to load it using even a credit card. But like when you withdraw money at an ATM, you know, you identify yourself at the ATM and authenticate yourself. Once you've withdrawn the cash from the ATM, or once you have Mintchip value in your Mintchip account, when you transact with cash or Mintchip, there's no personal information that is provided in the transaction. So in a typical Mintchip transaction, what is needed to have a transaction between the two chips, whether that's person to person or business to consumer, you provide the Mintchip ID that the value is being transferred to, the date and the amount of the Mintchip value, and that is it. So,
which works just the way cash does today.
Very much like cash does today, yes. And it's,
but of course,
it's also one of the other features of it. It is instantaneous,
right?
Because you are transferring an asset value from one secure chip to another, and the transfer is done very securely and instantaneously.
So, you know, there is control there are currency controls on how much money you can bring in, for example, into Canada or in the US, and if you're going to bring in more than the typical amount, I think, you know, generally it's around $10,000. Yeah, you have to declare that. But the nature of digital currencies in terms of the very low friction that will be able to move them around the system is a little bit different to cash in that, you know, okay, cash is a physical artifact that, you know, and there's some limitations in terms of how much you can draw out an ATM machine and how much you can realistically carry around with you. But digital currencies, you know, one of the great things about them is they lower the friction. So, you know, do you see that this is one of the big selling points of Mintchip, that it's just, it's easier to send that money around the system? And again, obviously the digital play, mobile and so forth, is playing that. And, you know, if you're selling this to the Canadian populace as to why they should start using Bitcoin, where's your head at in terms of the way you position it?
Well, very much you need to worry about friction because you really, in a sense, you're looking to consumers to change their behavior, so there needs to be incentives for them to want to do so. So privacy respected is one of them. But secondly, I think the fact that, as an example, the Mintchip product has features that really go beyond even cash because it's able to be transacted online. So it's got a plethora of channels over which you can use it. And that, in any one sort of product today, is really rare, where you can, again, back to bricks and mortar, with our upcoming pilot later this year, we will have an experience at a point of sale, as an example, where you wake up the application and you simply tap the application or your phone using near-field communications, NFC, to the point-of-sale terminal, and the value moves from your Mintchip account to the merchant's Mintchip account. So it has applicability in the bricks and mortar, as I said, online, and with peer-to-peer, it is extremely effective and, as you mentioned, cost-effective.
So how much, in terms of the Mint's role in this, how much are you working with the central bank and the sort of legal system in terms of paving the way for mint chimp to enter the Canadian economy?
Well, as I mentioned, it's in an R&D phase at the present time, but all through our project life cycle, if you like, we have been meeting with the central bank in Canada, which is the Bank of Canada, and as well with our shareholder, the government, the federal government of Canada, and been making them aware of our progress and the steps we're taking and the features that are in this particular product. So they're well aware of what we're doing and where we're going and understand the feature. We also met with regulators to ensure that they're aware of how we're architecting this particular product, which, by the way, doesn't require any networks to run on, and therefore brings that efficiency to the product.
Great. Well, Mark, please stick around after the break, because what we'd like to do is invite John back and have a bit of a discussion about where we go from here with the future of digital currencies.
I will.
Great. So we'll be back right after the break to talk what happens over the next 5 to 10 years with digital currencies like Bitcoin and Mintchimp.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
What does conscious leadership mean to you? It unites organizations instead of dividing them. By exploring commonly based business challenges, it guarantees an increase in your bottom line. Tune in to Minding Our Business, Creating a Spiritual Economy with your host, Nadine Rogers. Each week, we'll hear from business leaders and learn from their strategies. We'll talk about personal and organizational best practices that you can learn from, and we'll hear from you. Minding Our Business airs live Mondays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Business. Did you know that at the root of every business problem lies a communication issue? Communication Nation, a show that brings effective business communication practices to the masses, addresses a number of topics and talking points that impact your professional development, as well as business productivity and profitability. Host Jill Schiffelbein makes the theoretical tangible. Tune in each Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Be ready to become a better communicator with Communication Nation.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
So great to have you guys with us this week at Breaking Banks. We've been talking about Bitcoin, digital currencies, Mintchimp, and the path to credibility for these currencies. Now, during the break, John, we'll bring you back into the conversation here. You know, we were talking just briefly during the break in terms of the differences in approaches to this. You know, what are your thoughts about the way, or what comments do you have in respect to the way, the Canadian Mint is approaching this versus the way Bitcoin has sort of evolved? Do you have any comments or questions for Mark?
Well, definitely. I've been following the evolution of Mintchimp ever since it was announced, which wasn't too shortly after Bitcoin, I believe. And I really think that the Canadian Mint, Canadian government should be applauded for the efforts, because in some respect they're protecting they're attempting to protect anonymity and privacy as they get rid of coinage and small change. So that's admirable, because no other government has even really looked at that in a digital format. They're emphasizing the irrevocability, which I think is another important attribute. These transactions are not reversible, so they should be applauded for that. Where I run into difficulty, though, with Mint Chip is that I think that in the long run, it's going to run into trouble because it is relegated to an area of only low-value transactions. And that may be intentional because what they're attempting to
low-value transaction problem.
Yeah, what they're attempting to replace is the, you know, coinage and small change, small dollar transactions. But the low value and that may be intentional though because it's hardware based. So you know, we all know the weaknesses of the hardware based security, especially with the Apple iPhone just had their fingerprint technology hacked by the Chaos Computer Club. You know, there were bets on how fast the Mint chip would be hacked. So limiting it to low value transactions makes sense so that there's not a major compromise. So just to summarize, though, besides the fact that it is only expressed in Canadian dollars, which is a, you know, national governmental political unit, I think that what will end up happening, though, is because of the irrevocable nature of Mint chip, I would hope to see a lot of Canadians using Mint chip to purchase their Bitcoin.
Well, maybe, John.
I like
yeah.
That.
but no.
Mark, do you think as you know, if people start getting used to using this for micropayments or the small payments, you know, won't it just naturally extend to larger payments?
Well, it's interesting. We have purposely designed and architected really the product so far for low value payments, which is where we think, especially online, there's a problem that needs to be solved, being the cost of payment acceptance for low value transactions. We also think that there are markets to be ignited. And so, with the creation of new markets, we hope that, that will in fact, there'll be a larger market that we'll take a piece of. So, in terms of the value of the transactions, we believe because of, you know, the privacy respected and the kind of product digital cash and digital currencies are, that we believe that there will likely be a limit on the value of the transactions that can be used with Mintchip, I'll say, in the Canadian economy. And we probably believe and expect there to be perhaps a value assigned, a limit in terms of how much can be on any one particular Mintchip account. In terms of being hardware-based, really we're agnostic in terms of the types of medium that we transfer the value through. We can use any form factor when it comes to use, whether that's the physical phone, whether it's a card, whether it's on a fob. And it also can work in a local environment, in a trusted environment, in the phone itself, or through a cloud account. And who knows, maybe people will use the Canadian currency to buy Bitcoin.
So one other thing that I'm very interested in terms of, the payment space. You know, here in the United States, there's it's estimated that on AngelList, there's about 280, payment startups right now experimenting with this. But, you know, we have some pretty well-established rails in the payment system to date, which is, you know, we have the Visa MasterCard rails, we have the SWIFT network and so forth. And then interoperability or interconnectivity between banks exists in each of the local economies. But, you know, how are we going to go about creating interoperability in respect to digital currencies across border? Bitcoin appears to have sort of cracked this to some extent, John, but how do we go from there to create that interoperable standard for a digital currency?
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned SWIFT, because SWIFT is actually very interested in Bitcoin. We've been featured in their last two annual conferences, and If you look at Bitcoin as an international payment method, there really is no distinction to the user in terms of a domestic or an international transaction. It's just a transaction. And I think that SWIFT has really latched onto that idea. And the fact that the XBT code might be something for Bitcoin is very attractive to SWIFT in terms of their ability to clear and settle in Bitcoin, but also provide the role of maybe an escrow agent for large value transactions. People say, well, you know, if you have the Bitcoin network, doesn't that replace SWIFT and make SWIFT irrelevant? In some cases it would, but I think in other cases there is a role for an escrow agent to be in between, especially on large transactions for international trade. If you don't get your container showing up in your port, you're going to need some recourse.
Right. What do you think, Mark? How do we create, some standards? I mean, one of the great things about digital currencies is that low friction. And so the ability for these currencies to move in the digital sphere, does it really make sense to have a currency that's bound by borders, such as a digital currency that only works in Canada? Or would you see it being used outside of Canada's borders?
Well, I think there's room for both, quite frankly, going forward. I think there is a need for a global type of currency that you as a consumer, if you're living in the United States and you want to buy something online that's being sold out of China, you don't want to be worried about whether you got the proper currency in your account. So, back to the foreign exchange process is handled today and by current players, and there's no reason in a digital format
doesn't really change.
That same rule wouldn't be there, sure. So, I think there's also room for currencies within a country perhaps or within a territory.
So, you could be in London, for example. You could have your Bitcoin enabled account loaded on an app in a smartphone. And you go to an NFC point of sale terminal, and at the time you process a payment, it's going to convert those mint chip currency, for example, in real time. It'll just exchange it for sterling or euro or whatever the case may be through the normal Forex network that Visa or MasterCard operates.
There's no reason why it couldn't. With the advance in technologies, I mean, you also don't want to have your consumer have a not a good experience at the point of sale. So it would have to need to be done in terms of seconds or milliseconds.
So, guys, in terms of where we go from here, over the next 5 to 10 years, one of the questions is, that Bitcoin has really raised because of the level of activity and interest it's had, is the legality of this. I think there's this concept that's being tested in the market is a free market currency that's being created not by a central bank, but is used in the same way any other monetary instrument is used. Can that have the same legitimacy as a currency created by a central bank? And if not, how do we give it the recognition required such that it does have that same legitimacy? John, you got any thoughts?
Yeah, I'll take that one. I think that, as I mentioned before, the market-based legitimacy is paramount, and we live in a world right now with over 200 different legal jurisdictions. I think Bitcoin will tend to find a home in the most receptive jurisdictions. So that's another way of saying that the jurisdictions that erect barriers to Bitcoin will only be hurting their own citizens. They won't be hurting the rest of the world, and we may even start to see it play out along the lines of what we saw play out with online gaming and online poker, where the U.S. rejected any notion of online gambling, and those companies found a very profitable home in Gibraltar and Malta.
Right. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, like John, I think market-based legitimacy is something that people need to stand up and take notice of. I think the various payment products that will exist 5 to 10 years from now, I believe will only survive if they bring value to the consumer. Merchants will accept what their customers want to use. And so once that happens, I think people have to pay attention. We're in very early days as we speak.
Sure.
Things, and it will take time for this to evolve. But I think the time for digital currencies and digital cash-like products has arrived, we will just evolve from here.
And isn't it ironic, that paper currency, we're so used to that, and people are so passionate about that in terms of it being displaced and so forth. But in reality, it's only a couple hundred years old itself. So, the way people trade and the way people barter and buy and so forth is constantly changing, historically speaking. So it's pretty natural. So just as a closing statement, John, what's going to happen in the next 12 months for Bitcoin in 30 seconds?
I think we will start to see a lot more user-friendly apps, especially in the mobile arena, which will be great for adoption. We're already starting to see that, but I mean that it will get to the level where it will be just as easy to use as Skype or PayPal.
Great. And Mark, when is your pilot commencing for Mintship?
It's commencing before the end of this year, moving into next year, where the initial phase of it is with employees at the Royal Canadian Mint. Phase two in 2014 will be bringing in third parties into the ecosystem, both merchants and consumers, and a broker that's in our ecosystem. So
So we'd love to have you back to talk about that progress after you've got some more to tell us.
It'd be my pleasure, Brett.
John Matonis, the executive director of the Bitcoin Foundation, Mark Brulé, the CFO of the Royal Canadian Mint and looking after the mint chip. Thank you both very much for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks, Brett.
It was great, Brett. Thank you.
That's it from us. We'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.